Howdy, and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week's show is, perversely, a British actor turned first-time director special. We meet Samantha Morton to discuss her debut, The Unloved, a story of a young girl growing up in a children's home. And David Morrissey, star of diverse works including Nowhere Boy and Basic Instinct 2 on the big screen and Holding On and Gordon Brown in The Deal on telly, he tells us about his first feature, Don't Worry About Me, a romance set in his home city of Liverpool. Zan Brooks will be joining me to review James McAvoy and Helen Mirren in The Last Station, Saoirse Ronan in Peter Jackson's The Lovely Bones, and Jeff Bridges as country singer Bad Blake in Crazy Heart. Yes, it's hotter than a line dance and a bowl of chili. It's Film Weekly. Samantha Morton is a British actress who seems to have effortlessly become a Hollywood star. Rarely typecast, she's lent her considerable dramatic skills to films as diverse as Woody Allen's Sweet and Lowdown, Steven Spielberg's Minority Report, and most recently to the superb Charlie Kaufman film Synecdoche, New York. And all the while, she's been dreaming of stepping behind the camera to tell her own very British story. This week, her dream comes true as The Unloved, her first film, gets a theatrical release. The film tells the story of Lucy, a vulnerable 11-year-old whose problematic family circumstances result in her being sent to a state-run care home. Complex and painful, the story mirrors Morton's own early life spent in children's homes, and it's told with an eye and an ear for detail that can only come from personal experience. So when I spoke to Samantha, I started out by asking her about the very artful use of sound in her film.
Connor, say hello to Lucy.
I don't want to speak to someone I don't know. Move out of my face. Bye.
Nice.
Ben's in charge, or likes to think so. Grab your sausages today. You like sausages?
You're starving.
Yeah? This is the kitchen. You're not allowed in the kitchen unless one of the adults is in there. Okay. Let me take you through. Show you your room in a minute. That's the storeroom. We've got the washing machine down there. Have you got... Oh, you haven't got a bag, have you? We'll get some stuff for you. Here's Lauren and Sharon. Say hello to Lucy.
Hello.
You'll be sharing with Lauren. She's got the biggest room. We've got big TV, videos.
Con!
Yes.
What am I doing?
Yeah, you'll be sharing with Lucy.
I'm sharing the room now.
Yes.
Why couldn't you tell me this earlier?
I thought, how best can I make people feel how she feels very quickly? Whether is she dead? Is she having an out-of-body experience? Is she astral projecting? You know, is she autistic, Asperger? What's going on? And I think that when children are abused, often they throw themselves out of their body in a way, like their spirit, their soul is separate in some way to protect you, I suppose. And what used to happen to me when I was little and bad things happened to me is almost like I would be watching it from somewhere else, like from the corner of the room. And it was like, how can I get that feeling across? Okay, leaving a shot too long, having close-ups, extreme close-ups, followed by massive wide shots where you're in it and then you're shown the reality of it very quickly, which is what happens to her. She's kind of in a trance and then, boof, she's out of it. And with the sound starting very small and gently and building and building and building till you almost can't take it anymore, and it's like your head's going to explode and then, boof, and it's quiet. Yeah. Because that's the reality. And just hearing the fireplace, the click, 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 click of the fireplace, because that's the reality of that room in the day, and that's the real sound, you know? One thing that was very important to me was to listen to the sound without the print when I was editing. I needed to really hear the sound and not look at the pictures for a bit. And so it was very important to me when doing the music for the film, it should feel like its own creature and its own journey.
Yeah, no, and it really does, and I really thought that's you.
But so it doesn't stick out, though, as well, Jason. I didn't want it to be like, oh, you know, excuse me, you know, oh, dear, oh, that's wrong, or that doesn't feel right. It's my first film, so I'm learning about all of this at the same time.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how you learnt to do it? Because, I mean, I know you've obviously been in a lot of films, but were you paying attention all the time? Have you been sort of magpieing, or is there someone that you thought, they've been helpful?
I've spent nearly all of my life on a film set. So from the age of 12, when I was doing extra work for Murphy's Mob or Woof, or this thing about a boy with a dog, and, you know, nicking the sandwiches and taking them back to the children's home, I've always watched, and I've always asked questions, and I've always said to people, what's your favourite film? And I've learnt on the job. I've learnt how to act, and I think I've learnt, in a way, just how it all works. Not how to do it, but how it all works. So I will know what everyone does on a set. Obviously, some actors haven't got a bloody clue. They turn up and they, you know, where's my light, darling, kind of thing, and what's the scene all about? And I've always been interested I've always felt a bit... I get butterflies when I hear a camera going. With a real film camera, I get really funny feelings in my tummy, and sometimes that's about nerves, but most of the time it's because I get so excited. Like, I can't tell you. And I think that what I started to do, I suppose, from... or what I was like 19, 20, I suppose, I started to really, really believe that I was I had a calling for acting, so taking it more seriously than I ever had before. I was always very dedicated to acting, but I was still a kid then, do you know what I mean? And then, so what happened was I actually kind of went into myself a bit. So if I look back at those times, I think, did I learn anything from Woody Allen or Lynn Ramsey? Or of course I must have picked things up, but I was so concentrating on trying to give a really good performance and listening to my director and where do I need to stand and show me that shot on the monitor again, or let's watch that back so I can get that perfect for you, that I... To be honest, when it came to like the first day of shooting, after I'd done all the, you know, all the rehearsal for weeks and prep and pre-production and all that, it all went out of my head, and I thought I absolutely got petrified, and I thought, what do I do? And I had to, you know, I had Mike Elliott, who's my first AD, is also my co-producer along with Kate Ogbourne. I just had to take everything very simply and breathe.
Reading some stuff that you were doing when the film was first out, some interviews you'd done, you sort of said, this is it, that was my first film, I don't really want to do any other films, that was it, I wanted to get that off my chest, I've been planning this film since I was, you know, 16 or even younger. Get me if I'm wrong, I don't believe that you will not make another film, I think you will.
Do you know what, I really hope so, but it's not easy to make films, and it's this thing of I'm glad I had the innocence of thinking, oh yeah, I can make this film, because it got me through it. It was that naivety that got me through it. But now, you know what, it's okay getting, you know, fighting for years to get the money in and making it and then being really proud of it, and then you've got to get it into some festivals, and then oh, you've got to sell it. Oh shit, excuse my language, I've just sworn. But you go, oh, okay, well, does anyone want our film? Please have our film. And then they're all, you know, it's so hard. So, and it's taken, you know, 2 years out of my life in a way, and it's still, I'm talking to you now, and it's just been bought by Oscilloscope, which is brilliant in North America. So that's amazing, who also just released The Messenger that I'm in. So it was like, and that's a complete coincidence, but I'm just so excited, and I think, but you know what, they're not banging my door down.
No.
Nobody's asked me to direct anything, and nobody's made a call to say, you know, it's really interesting because I, you know, there are filmmakers that I admire hugely, okay, in this country, and they talk to me, go, oh, I can't get my film off the ground, can't get the money. And you go, but you've got so-and-so in it, and they want to do it, and they're going, yeah, can't get the money.
But you made da-da-da, and that was brilliant, and it won whatever.
Yeah.
And people it's rubbish working here, isn't it?
But you might know more about the politics of it, because I certainly don't.
Well, I wish I do. You know, I'm always banging the drum for, we've got so many talented filmmakers here, we just don't let them make films. I don't know what we make them do, but, in Hollywood or in America, they just go, you know, they just churn them out, I think, or they disappear. But, I mean...
I don't need lots of money to make my films.
No.
I know I don't. Use
this as a platform, Sam. Go on.
You what?
Use it as a platform for begging.
I'm really happy acting at the moment. I'm doing a really lovely, amazing Pixar job that is just a dream job.
Really? Are you a goldfish or something?
No. It's John Carter of Mars. Andrew Stanton's live action.
Oh, right. So it's real. All real.
And I'm loving it. But what's enabling me to do is go, right, I'm gearing myself up emotionally and physically to get the next project out, you know, get it done, and get people interested in wanting to support
it. So what are you in John Carter of Mars?
I play Solar, and that's all I'm going to say.
All right. I didn't know Pixar didn't do cartoons, so to speak.
It's Pixar Disney. It's their first live action.
Wow, that's exciting. Andrew Stanton did. He did
Wally
and
Finding Nemo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, they all do. They're all big, amazing community of very clever, amazing people.
And you're doing that here in the UK.
I am Shepperton.
Brilliant.
Got a day off.
Oh, right.
Oh, so it's great. I can talk to you.
Very lovely of you to do so. Well, that sounds very exciting. But also The Messenger, which I haven't seen, which is getting, you know, huge kind of accolades.
Woody Harrelson. I'm only an ickle part in it. I feel really, I'm really ickle in it. Kind of not really in it, but it's I think it's a wonderful film. And it was one of those ones where Oren Moverman, I'd worked with on Jesus Son all those years ago, and then, you know, there've been projects that we nearly did together that didn't happen. And then he sent me the film and said, you know, will you do it? And I was like, I've just had a baby. And I thought, you know, it's okay, 4 days filming? Yeah, come on then. So we got the family off to New York and I shot it. And I had an amazing time on it. And they were just, Woody Harrelson and Ben Foster are extraordinary, I think, in it. Steve Buscemi is in it, like me, like for a couple of scenes. And you come away and I can't stop. I mean, it took me ages to get his character out of my head because Steve Buscemi is so amazing in the film. And, you know, it's kind of filled with all these little cameos like me and Steve and Jenna Malone. And it's, you know, it's a really good film.
Well, I can't wait to see it. It hasn't got a UK distributor at the moment. I'm sure it will have after the awards, and because Woody's got a nomination as well. And the screenplay has as well.
So Woody is exceptional in it. I mean, I think, you know, I'm a huge Woody fan anyway, and he's such an amazing person, and I don't know, he does something incredibly rare in it. He's just so human and humble, and sorry to say this, this is going to sound very anti-American. I don't, because I love Americans, I love working there, but it doesn't feel like an American film, actually.
Because it's a while. It's nice to hear you talking about, you know, working on, you know, the big budget stuff or Hollywood as well. Because it's been a while since you were sort of in there. I know you were having.
I had a stroke.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
So, yeah, I know.
You know, I was just about to go off and do a film with Woody, and I had my stroke, and I had to recover. And then the minute I recovered, I turned around and I said to my fiancé, "I want a baby." So we had a baby.
Yeah, Edie, isn't it?
Yes, I had Edie.
How old is she now?
She's 2. But
brilliant.
Then I said, I want to make a film. So I kind of took nearly 4 years out, Jason,
yeah,
in a way.
I know. Are you better now? Are you all well? I mean, you were
well
last time.
Well, I was very better because I went straight off after I got recovered to do Schenectady, which we met at, that at the Barbican. But, I'm very better, and I'm actually, you know, I feel really, really good. Everything's great. You know, work's amazing. Life's amazing. And, you know, I couldn't have made, going back to The Unloved, I couldn't have made The Unloved really without having been in a good place inside, because I think making a film that is very personal and taking every aspect of the film very seriously, whether you're in control of, you know, because a lot of it's, you know, semi-autobiographical, so it's based on memory and photographs. You know, it goes to another part of you, and I think that it kind of, I felt like I ripped my heart out and put it on a slab and went, there you go.
And Samantha Morton's directorial heart on a plate, The Unloved, has a limited release here in the UK from Friday the 19th of February. For more information, go to the Institute of Contemporary Arts website, ica.org.uk, or you can check out the Channel 4 website, channel4.com. And if you want to read more of that wide-ranging interview with Samantha Morton, you can, as it's featured in this week's all-new Singing and Dancing Observer review section. Go to your shops. Joining me to review some of this week's other releases is Guardian critic Zan Brooks. Welcome, Zan.
Hello, Jason.
Samantha Morton's film, we just heard from Sam there, it went out on Channel 4 on TV. She told me that normally we think that's a shame, but she got 3 million viewers when it went out on TV. She's not going to probably get that many in the cinema, which is a shame, isn't it?
No, but she got me this time. I didn't see it when it was on TV, so I'm very glad to have had the opportunity to see it, because I think it's a really good piece of
She's
work.
She's a filmmaker, isn't she?
She is, yeah. I mean, maybe it wears its Ken Loach social realist influence a little too readily on its sleeve, but it's brilliantly acted and really moving. I think the final scene, the confrontation with the mum, is just gut-wrenching.
Yeah, it's one of these things that comes from somewhere, and I always love films that put their kind of heart out there for you, and I don't think you can make it. It's so personal.
Yeah.
I think it belongs in a genre of kind of almost memoir filmmaking, personal filmmaking.
Yeah, it's a good film, and it's got one of the best back-of-the-bus scenes, finales, of any film since The Graduate.
that's a good thing to have, actually.
Yeah, it's great.
Shifty had a good scene on one of those buses as well, leaving on a bus thing.
Yeah, it's always a winner.
That's a good genre as well. We shall address leaving on a bus scenes in cinema quite soon, I think, Zan. But first, we shall turn to Crazy Heart, which has its fair share of touring, I suppose. If not on a bus, then in a clapped-out jalopy, as Jeff Bridges stars as Bad Blake, the hard-touring, hard-living musician who, after many failed love affairs, might just have a chance to get something right with Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Tape recorder okay?
Go ahead, man.
You always dress for dinner. So, how'd you learn music?
My daddy. He had this old Washburn steel string. He couldn't play a lick on it. I picked it up, started fooling with it. Guess that's how.
Right. And what were you listening to?
A bunch of people you probably never heard of. Lulu Bell and Scotty. Emmett Miller. Georgia Wildcats. You ever hear them?
No, I never heard of the Georgia Wildcats.
No, I didn't figure that. About Hank Williams. Gene Autry. Waylon, them boys.
Right. Lefty Frizzell. What's your real name?
I'm Bad Blake. Wasn't born bad. When I die, my tombstone will have my real name on it. Until then, I'm just going to stay bad.
Now, there's an interview you would have liked to have, Zan. Bad Blake. You have actually interviewed Jeff Bridges, though.
I have, yeah.
His art mirroring life.
We didn't get it on.
No, really? What a shame.
It's a terrible shame for Jeff. He's devastated.
Gutted, yeah. So how was the dude?
The dude was very genial and amiable, as you'd expect the dude to be. And in fact, he said that the dude is the character who's closest to him in real life.
Does he like that, or does he want to get rid of him?
I think he likes it. He's a man who seems entirely at ease in his own skin.
With his dudeness.
Yeah.
How is he here? This is a Hollywood staple, isn't it? The kind of, the old ringmaster kind of one last shot at redemption. Yeah. I mean, it's as old as the hills.
It is, isn't it? There's a great bit where Bad Blake is writing a song. He's picking it out on his guitar and he says it's a good song because it sounds like you've heard it someplace before. And this is a film that feels like you've seen it someplace before. But it's also okay.
Where
I don't
have
mind
you seen it
that.
Before? I keep trying to
Well, we saw it kind of last year with The Wrestler, with Mickey Rourke.
Exactly.
This is maybe that the palette isn't quite as dark here. Bad Blake is a bit of a drunk and a stumble bum, but he doesn't quite sink to the same depths as Mickey Rourke. But I think Oscar voters like this kind of character, and I think Bridges is probably the favourite to win the Best Actor award. And in a way, that's deserved, but it's also deserved because it's a kind of cumulative thing. Well, it's his body of work. He's been around for ages.
Absolutely, but here he gets to do the slight. He's always been a rather beautiful man, I think. And he's done Ravage before, I think, in The Fabulous Baker Boys. It's almost that character who was as a bit of a jazz man, and here he is as a country and western man. I liked him when he was in The Fabulous Baker Boys, absolutely. But I think he got blown away by Michelle Pfeiffer's character.
Making Whoopi.
Absolutely. But there he was playing his jazz dreams out in dive bars every night. And we get a lot of that here. Perhaps a little bit too much for my taste, given that he's not the best country and western singer in the world.
His voice perhaps isn't great, but I thought the songs were good. I mean, as country western songs go, they were good.
Well,
they were written by T-Bone Burnett
and
Stephen Bruton, who I think has died since. But these are friends of Bridges, and they obviously had a sort of high old time making it. And you've got Colin Farrell as the rival country western star. And the songs and the milieu all sound right.
It's the love affair, however, which is sort of at the beating heart of this. I mean, he gets his belly out, he's drunk and all that stuff, and he does all
throws
that really
up in well. The toilet.
Yeah, absolutely, before he goes on stage. But then he does meet the redemptive sweetheart, Maggie Gyllenhaal, who, of course, is a lot younger than him. And Maggie Gyllenhaal does this quite a lot as well, it strikes me as I'm looking. She's always playing the sort of hard up single mum. She was brilliant in Sherry Baby not so long ago. And it was a very similar part here, I thought.
I think you're right. Nobody's sort of exactly out of their comfort zone on this film. In a way, it plays it safe. It's like an old standard. It's almost like a karaoke movie that it comes on and you sort of hum along to the different beats and the different changes and the middle eight and the final chorus, and you know kind of where it's going. But there's something oddly comforting about that, particularly when it's well acted like this is.
We were talking about 44 Its Chest a few weeks ago, and some people accused that of being theatrical, if you like, because it was fairly stage bound, if you like. To me, this is the theatre of cinema. This is the King Lear, this is the Mousetrap, this is the old staple. Yeah. And when done well, it's a perfectly good night out.
It's the American staple, isn't it? It's basically the Wild West hero who's fallen on hard times and he's searching for home.
Yeah, so it's Shane-ish. But where else have we seen this? I'm waking up in the middle of the night thinking, where else have I seen this redemptive story? Man with a Golden Arm, Frank Sinatra doing it, coming out of jail as that kind of guy. In the 60s, I thought Ray Millen did it in Days of Wine and Roses. I've seen it a lot before, but it's always nice to see it.
Yeah, or Paul Newman in The Verdict.
The Verdict is the one that came to me about 5:30 in the morning after I'd gone to sleep having thought about it.
Always have your best thoughts at 5:30 in the morning.
Oh, dear. That's Jeff Bridges, who probably win an Oscar. Maggie Gyllenhaal, who might well win an Oscar. She is nominated. I've noticed about Maggie Gyllenhaal. I'm a bit worried about her. I mean, get it while you're young, but every film that contains it, she has to show her knickers off. In there's always a shot that goes down her very tight belly, well done Maggie, to her knickers. I think she needs a new stunt knicker.
I think it's in her contract.
Oh, okay.
She's got an endorsement.
It's Pretty Polly or whatever they are. Victoria's Secret. Well done, that's Crazy Heart. Then we move on to The Lovely Bones, adapted from Alice Sebald novel, directed by Peter Jackson and executive produced by Channel 4's own Tessa Ross. It's the story of a young girl who's murdered and tells the story from her point of view, floating in some limbo. From there, she can view a detective seeking out her murderer.
Mr. Harvey.
Yes?
Detective Len Fenerman.
How you doing?
Do you have some time for a few questions?
Certainly. Come on.
Thanks.
I know why you're here, of course. I think when something like this happens, you always blame yourself. All I can think about now is, why didn't I see something or why didn't I hear something? Because surely that young girl must have screamed. Did you want?
No, thanks, I'm fine. But if you could just think back, I mean, she was wearing a blue jacket, yellow corduroys, mm-hmm. similar clothes to these.
Mm-hmm. This blue jacket here?
The darker blue jacket.
Uh-huh.
And on the second photograph, you could see the pants as well.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No. It does not ring a bell.
Michael Imperioli from The Sopranos and Stanley Tucci from about everywhere this year, playing Mr. Harvey, the creepy serial killer. He's got an Oscar nomination for this role. The film itself, Zan, I know you saw the premiere of it and have had a few issues floating around like Saoirse Ronan's character in the ether ever since.
I think that this is oddly a fascinating film, maybe for all the wrong reasons, in that it's a big, polished, high-grade Hollywood film by an established, very talented director where everything is slightly wrong. It's like every aspect of this film is maybe 10, 15 degrees out of kilter. And it's weird to see.
Because there are bits which aren't bad at all and bits which are almost clever. Is it, in fact, the idea that's wrong? Is it making a film told by a dead 14-year-old girl sort of impossible to make?
Partly. It's based on the Alice Sebald bestseller, which I had similar problems with in the way that it marries this central horror of the rape and murder of a teenage girl with this sort of sugary, winsome adolescent flight of fantasy with watching it down from limbo and it's all wonderful. Yeah,
limbo is like some kind of hippie fashion shoot kind of wonderland thing.
Yeah, and that is a very difficult thing to make gel. But I think that the Sebald novel maybe earned its flight into fantasy because it showed us the horror, whereas Jackson doesn't. It's about the rape and murder of a kid. The murder is unseen, the rape is unmentioned, and there's something weirdly coy about it. And he said in interviews that he wanted to make the sort of a PG-13 film, so it's a film that his daughters can see. And you think, why then make a film that hinges on the rape and murder of a kid?
Yeah, where's the musical that you need for that? I mean, it's true, because it's kind of gruesome, but not. It's almost soft soaps gruesomeness, isn't it? It's very acceptable. This is kind of a sink with a bit of blood in it. And you just think, well, you know, I see worse on CSI.
And yet, the paradox of that is that it actually makes it feel more creepy and crass when you see those things. The rest of the film is so coy that when you see the blood or when you see Stanley Tucci as almost the identikit kind of suburban weirdo of his little glasses and moustache and his models, one day perhaps you will, and The Lovely Bones too, it just feels a bit cheap.
Yeah, I also thought the comic tone was a bit uneasy because it starts with a sort of, you know, her younger brother is choking to death and she does this kind of comedy drive to the mall.
It's like Ferris Bueller's
Day Off. Everyone's like looking around going, and I'm like, is this a comedy, this film? And it's got Susan Sarandon as the kind of hard-drinking, hard-smoking mother-in-law. There are elements in here which are sort of from other movies, and I didn't know how it all gels together. And yet I was curiously hooked. It's quite a long film, and I never felt bored because I was wondering what confection he would come up with next. Was it a vision of heaven that was full of children and singing dogs, or would it be, you know, a gruesome serial killer trying to bury the bones? It was a strange mix.
I agree with you in that it's never boring, but I think it's never boring because it's never boring in the way that a car crash isn't boring. You kind of look at the pile up on the M4 and you think, wow,
look at those.
You know, that is a real mess. And you just make dumb decisions. There's like these kind of knowing references to himself. He goes past the bookshop and it's advertising The Lord of the Rings, and then Peter Jackson himself crops up in a little sort of Hitchcockian cameo.
Does he? I missed that.
Yeah, he's in the photography store at the beginning.
Is he?
And you think, if you're going to take this seriously, this story, take it seriously. Don't do these sort of knowing nudges and winks.
Yeah, look, it's me, guys, everyone. Yeah.
We're going to get to the murder of the girl in a bit.
Did he have his little beard and everything?
Yeah, yeah, he's there.
I thought it was a hobbit, you see. I mistook him. The man who mistook his director for a hobbit. The last stations, and we shall move on to, talking of beards, Christopher Plummer, sports one here, got himself an Oscar nomination, as did Helen Mirren as his wife. It's the story of Tolstoy's last days when he set up a Tolstoyan commune, and his wife is very concerned that the will might be going to the good of the others rather than the good of her own family. Therefore, his best friend, Vladimir Cherkov, played by Paul Giamatti, interviews Valentin Bulgakov, played by James McAvoy, to spy on Tolstoy.
Last summer, I arranged for a manservant who proceeded to ruin two housemaids. Just like that, he was very upset.
This would not be a problem with me. I'm a vegetarian. I am celibate. I'm also a vegetarian.
My dear boy, if you were to become Tolstoy's private secretary, you would be given a great gift.
Vladimir Grigorovich, please know that I understand what a privilege this position presents. But since becoming a Tolstoyan, I have become so eager to learn, to discuss ideas, to perfect my very soul.
Well, we have a lot to do if we are to get his work to the people.
Zan, are you a Tolstoyan?
I'm not sure I am, and I'm not sure this film will convert me.
It didn't explain to me what that was.
It doesn't at all, but it's not interested in that. I guess there are two routes you can go with this story. You can do the big political saga, or you can do the domestic farce. And director Michael Hoffman very much goes for the domestic farce. So you've got Helen Mirren giving a slightly hysterical performance as Sophia, running in and out of the study, looking for the will and shouting in a nightgown. You've got James McAvoy in a slightly dispiriting role as the private secretary, who has the hilarious thing of sneezing whenever he's nervous.
He reminded me
of... He's like Rodney out of Only Fools and Horses.
He reminded me of Woody Allen in Love and Death.
Yes, it is like that.
He eats too much red meat.
It is like that. And, you know, Christopher Plummer is a sort of reliably dignified performer and brings, I think, the right mixture of gravitas and playfulness to the role of Tolstoy. But everybody else, I think, is slightly all at sea here.
I didn't really know what this film was about. I mean, it's supposed to be the end of days for Tolstoy and he's worried about his will, but there's sort of nothing really happens at all. And I kept watching going, and your point is what? I mean, it didn't really anchor his importance in the world.
Not
there's
at
all sort of figures turning up and trying to take early photos of him and said Tolstoy was a world famous figure. So I got that from the film.
Yeah.
But I didn't get any of his greatness, any of his wit, any of his tragedy, any of the kind of ensuing kind of revolution that might overtake Russia. I sort of didn't get anything of that.
No, I think I got the sense that the Russian scenery can look very pretty. And some of the Russian peasant girls are very fetching.
Aren't they?
And that is the that seems to be the abiding interest of this film. It's a bit flat, really.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know what's going on.
Maybe, again, a bit like The Lovely Ones. From the start, maybe it wasn't that good an idea. I would have got the script. And there's me sitting like Woody Allen in Love and Death. I would have got the script. There's just no jokes in it at all. There's nothing there.
But why should there be jokes?
Because isn't it a farce? There's people running
know.
It out. There's people running around,
know.
Sneezing.
Perhaps it should be a farce. There's a moment where Helen Mirren's tearing up the office and Christopher Plummer says, "You don't need a husband, you need a Greek chorus." And I thought, actually, we need some canned laughter here, because that would clue us into
exactly.
That we're
well,
supposed
Woody
to
Allen,
find this
give
really
me a
funny.
A medium-sized chuckle right here.
Yeah,
he had a Greek
some
chorus.
Booing,
mighty,
I think.
Yes, a large suck of horse manure. I just couldn't really bear this film.
Why has she been nominated for this?
Well, because
weird.
She's the queen.
Yeah, she's the queen, but the crown has slipped.
Yeah. That's The Last Station, and I think the last straw for Zan and me this week. Zan, nice to see you. Thank you very much indeed for your reviews this week. If you want to hear more of Zan, see more of Zan, and read more of Zan's interviews, go, as ever, to guardian.co.uk/film. Our second well-known British acting face to steal the camera and doff the director's cap is David Morrissey, most recently seen in his role as Bobby in Sam Taylor Wood's John Lennon biopic Nowhere Boy. Morrissey is a son of Merseyside, so it's fitting that his first film is a homage to Liverpool. I met up with him for my In the Director's Chair video series to find out more about his debut film, Don't Worry About Me.
I'm going to have to go.
What? Can't you call in sick or something?
You soft, they've just seen me all morning.
Tell him your nan's sick.
My nan's like an ox, she doesn't get sick.
What about Danny?
No one's sick.
Let's go shopping. I'll buy you a present.
I don't want a present. I've got to go back to work. I need the money.
You can have some of this money. Sorry, I'd just like to spend the afternoon with you, that's all. You can show me the sights.
Yeah, I mean, the film that deals with a London boy who goes up to Liverpool in the pursuit of one girl, and he gets up there and she's not quite as single as he thought, and so he's abandoned in this city that's a strange city to him. And he ends up in a bookies, and he meets this other girl in the bookies, and she sort of takes him around her city. Mm. And it is about the effect the city has on them. It's 24 hours in their life. And she's sort of carrying a secret, and it's about telling strangers things that we would never tell our most intimate friends.
Right? It's strangely my favourite types of films. I mean, I know we live in a world where Avatar it dominates everything, but my favourite kind of films are two people walking around somewhere talking.
Yeah.
I mean, I just have always loved this, and it's as a first-time director, it's some kind of relief. I mean, because you know you're not going to get the budget to do a 3D spectacular.
That's true, and you're looking all the time for influences in that way. Can't I do this? So you see things like Before Sunset and Before Sunrise, and you think, well, that can be done. You know, people will stay with this, an audience will stay with this. And also for me, budgetary wise, it was, it cost me £100,000. So it was interesting to also watch films like London to Brighton and Once and see that also technically it could be done as well. So I had those examples at my fingertips. I knew that some people out there had gone on this journey and got to the end of it, so why couldn't I?
Yeah, I mean, people do it at various stages. I mean, Annie Hall is sort of one of those movies. There was a lovely one in Los Angeles recently called In Search of a Midnight
That's
Kiss,
right, yeah.
Which I was really thinking of in yours, because that took me to... That I saw places in Los Angeles that I'd never seen before, and equally, I'd been to Liverpool a few times, but in your film, I saw places in Liverpool that I'd certainly never seen before.
Me too. That's the great thing about going back to my own city after, 20-odd years of being here in London. The city's changed so much. It's changing rapidly. You know, there's been the city of culture since I has been away and stuff like that. But new buildings, the whole of the waterfront. There's one shot in my film where you see the classic waterfront shot of the Liver buildings and shots that we know from Brookside and the Liver Birds and stuff like that. But the very next shot is this whole modern city growing up next to that city.
Tell me how you got the project as well, because you're credited as a co-writer on it. You're two actors in it. They wrote a stage play, is that right?
They did. What happened was that it was a play called The Pool that they'd written as drama students, and they'd taken it to Edinburgh. And really, they'd written it in order to give themselves something to do. And it was, the story structure is very much the same as the film, except the scenes were interlinked with these rhyming couplets, which were very sort of convoluted and quite strange, and I didn't like them. And I read a review for it, and I thought, well, I'll go and see it. And it immediately didn't strike me as a movie, but the basic concept of two people, 24 hours in my city, that sort of struck
Is that
me.
Why you went to see, you saw a review of it?
Yeah, I saw a review and I thought, I wonder if this will work. I was, at the time, I knew that I had to make a film for a lower budget. So I was reading lots of scripts, meeting with writers, having ideas myself, and then read this review, went to see it. So it was one of a long list of things that I was considering. And then I met Helen and Jamie, who are in it and also wrote it. And I said, I'd like to work on this basic idea and I'd like to open it up. And because they'd been with the characters for, you know, over a year at that point, I knew I needed two people who knew the characters so well that I could just throw things at them. So I decided to cast them as well, which they were obviously very pleased about. And they responded really well. It was their first time on film as well.
So everyone's kind of doing their first time. When I say you're a first-time director, of course you are, but you've been on telly, on stage, you've been in movies from big budget ones, Hollywood ones.
I directed a couple of shorts and I directed some TV as well, but this is my first feature and certainly the first time that I've been producing and directing as well as co-writing. So all those hats at once was quite a challenge for me.
So were you looking for a project to do? You knew you wanted to do this and
actually make this feature.
And you were just looking around. So when you're doing that, looking for a project, are you... You're learning how to make a film as
well? Yeah, you are. I mean, the other thing for me was I'd had two scripts which were I'd been trying to finance for about 4 or 5 years, and they had a budget of about $6 to $7 million each. That's what they were looking at, and I really hammered away at them. And and I got halfway some of the money some people had promised me. I got actors attached to it, and then had to drop out, and that was a long time, and I was getting quite frustrated by that. And so I decided to find out how much money I could raise. And I bypassed the film community completely and I went to the business community. Yeah. And I set up a business EIS plan and just said, listen, you know, this is a tax efficient scheme. Would you like to invest? And they all invested at a low level.
How did you come up with that idea?
I met a businessman and just said, listen, I want to make a film. Who, you know, my brother's a businessman, and he introduced us to some people, and they came up with that plan. And it's not talking to other filmmakers, it's a plan that lots of people have used, obviously at a higher end than mine. Mm. But that's why, you know, encouraging that business to come to this country, that's where that tax incentive is.
The humour comes through quite quickly. And I mean, it's almost a sort of awful cliche to sort of say, well, the Scouse humour comes through.
Yeah.
It's sort of impossible, though, to make a film without that humour coming through, isn't it?
I think Liverpool does have a humour that can be a defence mechanism. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like they take the mickey out of people to see if they can take that. And also they don't mind that happening to them slightly. But with Tina particularly, I think, with the character that Helen plays, it's very much humour as a weapon. She's trying to keep people away from her in that way. She doesn't want to get too intimate with people. And it's just taking the mickey. And I think our Southern character finds that slightly difficult at first, but yeah. He has to warm to that.
I have to say that, you know, it's always terrible to choose between two characters in them, and invariably, right. As a bloke, I would say that I always thought the woman was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think it's a brilliant performance from
she's
her.
Great,
Helen,
yeah.
Her eyes are just.
And both of them are like new to film, and I think, you know, as a director, you're looking at performance and thinking, are we going to get this? You know, particularly with new actors. And I was so heartened by them once the camera went on them, and I was watching Rushes and thinking, it's really going to work. And also the one thing that they were never used to was that sense of telling it out of order. You know, they've been doing it up for a play for a year, which obviously has a lineal sort of storytelling, and they were suddenly being asked to do the end first and then do this scene in the middle and stuff, and they were all over the place. And but they got to that very quickly. They were great with that.
So if you go to Liverpool, when you get lost, I mean, as a Londoner, if I have a night out in Liverpool, you're going to go to a bookies, you're going to get drunk, you're going to eat a sausage in a cafe, you're going to get beaten up by some girls.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah. But only if you're cruel to one of their own.
Right.
I think that's the thing. What I like about that scene is these girls see this man effectively, you know, manhandling this woman, and they're not having it. They're going to get involved. So they're sort of your knight on shining armour are two girls with pushchairs, really. So that's where they come in.
I thought that was
also. What was great with these girls was I said to them, he's really going to want to get past you so he can get to this girl. Don't let him pass at all. And they really went for it. And that was great. And Jamie, the leading actor, was covered in bruises down his legs for days to come. So that was really good.
That'll learn you. Don't take on the Liverpool girls.
Never do that.
Brilliant. I mean, it's part of the same scene. That's a brilliant, surreal image of smacking this teddy bear.
Yeah, they
which
were.
Is both surreal and funny, but quickly turns quite dark.
He needs something to sort of vent his anger on, and all he's got is this cuddly toy, which when they first get it seems to be this romantic, silly sort of gesture that they've got. But during the scene, because it sort of turns pear-shaped, it becomes a burden to them. But they've got to keep hold of it. And then we take that full circle, and we see that the bear will have a nice home, I think, as well. So, but yeah, it was quite weird filming that day, because obviously where we filmed in New Brighton, there was quite a lot of people there, and I had the Jamie beating hell out of this bear in the comments. So I wish I'd had a microphone on those comments, because they were quite funny.
But great old Scouse comments there. You see, that's priceless stuff.
That's
you're
what
missing
we needed.
It.
I know.
Well, I'm glad. I was lovely to see it. It was brilliant.
Thank you very
really
much.
Enjoyed. Don't you worry about me. It's funny and it is tender, but it is. It made me laugh quite a lot.
Right.
And I think that's a kind
it's
of
very, important.
Very difficult thing to do.
Right.
And keep the humour bubbling along, and then usher in all the. Well, all the other themes like religion and music and mums and brothers and family. And it's all in there. Don't you worry about me. So I'm not worried about the future of you as a director, David. And if you, when you do it, do come back in the director's chair again.
Love to. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Thank you.
My thanks to David Morrissey for coming in to us here at The Guardian. For more information on all of David's directorial projects, and there are plenty, why not visit his website, davidmorrisseyonline.com. And if you want to see that interview, which is part of my In the Director's Chair series of videos, just go to guardian.co.uk/in-the-director's-chair. That's all for this week. The music you've been hearing in the podcast was, of course, the lilting country sounds of Crazy Heart with the vocals of Jeff Bridges, the dude, a natural crooner, as you can hear. Meanwhile, I'm heading down to the London Film Critics Circle Awards. I'm the chairman this year, and of course Tarantino will be there, Vittorio Storaro collecting an award for Apocalypse Now, plus some winners which will make headlines. We will bring a flavour of that award ceremony to you on Film Weekly next week. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.